Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books Archaeology, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Samuel Pfister, and joining me today to talk about his trilogy on the history of Egyptology, titled Wonderful Things, is Jason Thompson. Jason is the editor of Edward William Lane's Description of Egypt and an Account on the Manners and Customs of the Modern Egyptians, and is the author of Sir Gardner Wilkinson and His Circle and A History of Egyptology from Earliest Times to the Present. All three volumes of Wonderful Things, A History of Egyptology, are out now from American University in Cairo Press. Jason, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm glad to be with you. How are you, Sam?
Doing well. Can't complain. So let's get right into the questions here. So tell us about Wonderful Things. Give us an overview of the series.
Well, Wonderful Things is a survey history of the history of Egyptology, not of ancient Egypt, but of the process of the sometimes called rediscovery of ancient Egypt, the intellectual creation of ancient Egypt even. And it covers from antiquity until the present. That raises the interesting question, of course, of when did Egyptology actually begin? Many, perhaps most, hold out for 1798 and Napoleon's invasion and brief conquest of Egypt with the activities of the commission, the scientific commission that accompanied him, and that resulted in the great Description de l'Egypte, which is literally a publication, a monument of Egyptology. There are others who hold for 1822 and the publication of Champollion's Lettre au Monsieur Dacier, which with great oversimplification is taken to be the decipherment of hieroglyphs. If I were to look at recent times, I would think toward the end of the 19th century with the professionalization of Egyptology, which in fact is the beginning of one of my books. But I wanted to take into account Egyptology in a very broader sense, you know, the involvement with ancient Egypt, which stretches into antiquity. I mean, Egypt was ancient even during antiquity. A New Kingdom scribe looking at the step pyramid at Saqqara and inscribing a bit of graffito on the wall about his amazement was already looking back 1,000 years. And Egyptian antiquity was so important to Rome, it's present in medieval times, and ever more so in Renaissance and Enlightenment. And I wanted to take those things into account as well. Hence the millennia of time involved.
Yeah, and now these books aren't the first titles on Egypt and about Egyptology that you've written or edited. So where did this lifelong interest in Egypt and the history of ancient Egypt and Egyptology come from?
That's a question that that's occurred to me over time. But leading, you know, to these particular three volumes, there are two threads that were closely involved. One, accidental serendipity, and the other, programmatic. It actually began one hot summer 1977 in East Texas when I happened to be reading Brian Fagan's The Rape of the Nile, just come out then. And that was my first exposure to Egyptian archaeology. Anyway, several years later, when I was at the University of Chicago and needed a seminar paper, I remembered a footnote, no, actually an endnote, in Brian's book, where he mentioned that there was not a biography of Sir Gardiner Wilkinson, or John Gardiner Wilkinson, as he was before his knighted. And I thought, well, I'll do a little essay on that. But that left some uninterested questions, so I pursued it into my PhD dissertation. And then there was still more to do, more research, new frontiers, and residence in Egypt. And that led to my book about Gardiner Wilkinson in 1992. But in doing Wilkinson, I'd become interested in his friend, the British Egyptologist Edward William Lane. And that was a large project that consumed a good many years, with two books and maybe a dozen articles about various aspects of him and his circle, because it was actually a prosographical work, a work of collective biography, not just a biography. But even with Lane and Orientalism, there's no escape from Egyptian antiquity, because he was deeply involved in it. And so when the Lane project ended, and also I was able to complete my survey history of Egypt from earliest times to present, I wanted to make a statement about Egyptology as an event in cultural history, and as something that I had become interested in, and that I thought I had some perspective from my outside point of view. Bear in mind, I am, by certificate, a historian of Britain and the British Empire, especially in the Eastern Mediterranean, Middle East, and Egypt. And so it was, for me, an opportunity, I thought, to close out a longstanding thread of inquiry. And I was received a contract to write a one-volume history of ancient Egypt, of the history of Egyptology. Now, the other is programmatic. As a historian of the British Empire, but someone who is also interested in the Middle East, both contemporary and ancient, I wanted to be neither one nor the other. I wanted to place myself between them and study the process of encounter. And that takes many aspects, but the study of Egyptian antiquity is an encounter, in fact, a double dose of encounter, because on the one hand, the process of Egyptology is part of modern Egyptian and Middle Eastern history. But also, there's a strong element of encounter with the ancient Egyptians. It's rather difficult to describe, but there's nothing else quite so poignant that as that. The feeling of, on the one hand, familiarity, almost welcomed, especially by their artistic representations, and yet as one gets to know them better, finding that they're so utterly alien from us.
Yeah, and one thing I can really tell, in reading this series, is that you do approach it as a biographer. There are really great backgrounds on a lot of the Egyptologists, but you also do a great job of sort of weaving this with, you know, embedding their stories and their lives in the current events of their time and how that shaped their work and how their work, you know, in turn shaped those events. You know, one of the things I was so impressed by was just the comprehensiveness of all of the detail in each volume. There's so many characters, so many Egyptologists, so many excavation projects to keep straight, and, you know, important events to chronologize and contextualize all of this work. And you really wove these details with sometimes intimate and sympathetic or critical narratives. So with such a large project like this, can you describe your approach to your research a little bit? Describe your research strategy.
Well, first, there's the resources and the support that one derives from what's gone before and others who are working in the field or similar fields now, because history of Egyptology is a rapidly growing field. And so there are a lot of predecessors. Egyptology, professional Egyptology, has always been retrospective. Those early volumes published by the Egypt Exploration Fund, as it was then, almost always carried a good retrospective in understanding what had gone before. Egyptology has a biographical a dictionary. Who was who in Egyptology? It's an extraordinary resource, I think, now being put into its fifth revised edition by Maurice Beerbrier, an unusually rich resource for it. The history of Egyptology is obituaries. I mean, other disciplines, their journals have obituaries, but Egyptologists have an extraordinary facility for writing obituaries. They are the best. And then the interaction, there are more conferences, sections at conferences, and more interaction between researchers. I've benefited from all of that. And then moving ahead, of course, there's the vast extent of Egyptological literature. How many lifetimes would it take to read it all? Fortunately, it's very well organized with bibliographical guides and reasonably well cross references, so we can follow the debates, but above all, the development and indeed the creation of knowledge. Now, how does one cope with such as best one can, trying to keep aware of the field overall, but also understanding that the true significance, say, of a particular book might not be in its thesis, but in a passing comment in a footnote on page 272. But you know, it's there and ready to be mined. The most exciting thing, I suppose, is the archival dimension. And there are a number, and an increasing number, of Egyptological archives. For me, the first and the last will always be the Griffith Institute of the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. And that's where I spent so much of my time working on Wilkinson and later preparing my book about Edward William Lane. But there are others, the archives of the British Museum, BRICH, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. There's another new and very strong archive in Milan. The great libraries of the world, the British Library in particular, is rich for early 19th century archaeology. The research centers, the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago, is very good for 20th century archaeology, and more specialized in their field work at the Epigraphic Survey at Luxor, an extraordinary textual and visual archive. I suspect we'll be hearing a lot from that direction in a few years, as the Epigraphic Survey, or Chicago House, as it's popularly called, celebrates its 100th anniversary. Now here too, there's the problem of size. And I haven't even mentioned the large number of private collections, and sometimes in local archives that are just now being identified. There's more here than most individual researchers' time and money would allow to cover. But fortunately, an increasing amount of this is being done online, and researchers at remote corners of the world can readily access a particularly valuable resource at this moment.
Yeah, truly the abundance of writing on Egypt and Egyptological writing that's been produced over the past however many centuries and millennia is both is extraordinary, but
it is wrangling indeed. That
and synthesizing it into it.
But mm-hmm. I should add one of the most important elements of all, and that's the sense of place. You know, long-term residence in Egypt, seeing the sites and understanding the sites, places have histories and lives of their own. Although I'm always careful to add that these are infused by individuals who identify them, give them meaning, and provide them with stories. So over the years, I'm glad to have been able to have traveled as extensively as I can up and down the Nile, and in both deserts. I'm especially fortunate to have been a long-term member of the Dakhla Oasis Project, which is doing valuable work in the Western Desert. And some of my happiest writing times have been there. And then personal residence, not only in various neighborhoods in Cairo, such as Mohandasin or Mahdi, but more recently, and in some ways more meaningfully, in the Eastern Cemetery in Kite Bay, where my adoptive Egyptian family have a building. And there, in that particular milieu, and especially close by the vast cemeteries, I also got an important insight into Egyptian life. There's no such thing as eternal Egypt. Things change, but other things stay the same. And as I would see people visiting their ancestors' tombs and bringing food and offerings and enjoying picnics there with them, that's one of many, many things that provide a strong sense of continuity when you can live as closely as possible with the Egyptian people.
Yeah, and it goes back to what you were saying before, that the study of the past of Egypt, it really has to include an understanding and study of the present of Egypt as well. So the title of this series, Wonderful Things, comes from the almost legendary discovery of the tomb of Pharaoh Tutankhamun. Why was this moment so important in the history of Egyptology, and what made this discovery so unique or so extraordinary that it's been canonized the way it has as one of the most pivotal moments in the history of Egyptology?
I have to say, I do love that title, and I think it is a brilliant title. I can say that with perfect modesty because it was suggested by my good friend and able copy editor, Abdallah Hassan. And I think it added a great touch to it. But those are beautiful and memorable words. Why was that discovery so important? Well, at the time, many Egyptologists asked that same question, and not with good intent. George Reisner, for example, his extraordinary work with the tomb of Queen Hatshepsut at Giza created no popular sensation at all, although it was done with extraordinary care and was a great work of scholarship and archaeology. Later, Montet at Tanis with his discovery of the intact tombs there created almost no impression on the public. So what made it so extraordinary? Of course, there's the element of gold, and it came at the right moment. At Tanis, it was a matter of silver, which doesn't have quite the same cachet. And also, it's a matter of fashion. Part of these recurring waves of Egyptomania that are a periodic reality of Egyptological history. What drew me more and more was the role of Howard Carter and the effect that it had on his life and on his reputation. He was so poorly regarded by Egyptologists who would not have considered him even one of him, and to some degree not of their class, with a couple of exceptions. Yet, even if he had never discovered that tomb, which in some ways became his curse, another important part of the sensation, even if he had never discovered that tomb, he already had accomplished more than most Egyptologists can never dream of doing. So that, to me, was the ultimate story about the discovery. But it was sensational, and it continues to be so. I don't know how many times at the Egyptian Museum I would be stopped by someone newly arrived there and say, "Where is the Tutankhamun collection?"
Yeah, and you teased that the mummy's curse a little bit that ended up biting Howard Carter was not sort of the legendary mummy's curse that supposedly made others who were involved with its discovery sick. Do you mind telling a little bit about the story of Howard Carter after his discovery of the tomb?
Yeah, well, Carter, I could be a rather short-tempered man, and the success came back to bite him, first as he attempted to clear the tomb. Now, on the one hand, he had extraordinary support. The well-equipped expedition on the other side of the ridge at Deir el-Bahari provided him with material support personnel, and especially, of course, the superb photographic record provided by Harry Burton. The Antiquities Service also stepped up with support, but the sensation, the irritation, the gawking tourist who could not be kept at bay, frayed at his nerves. And by the end of the first season, his helpers were saying, "Thank heaven, it's over, because we really do need a break." The problem, I think, was that saddened his life in later years and made those years a bit pathetic was a sense of diffidence, of insecurity, in that he felt he was deficient in education. He didn't necessarily know the right things to say and do. He had, after all, been hired as an artist in the first instance, because one of his qualifications was he was not a gentleman. In other words, a cut down in the class. And he never wrote up the real report, the full account of the discovery. In some ways, it never has been properly reported, but it's so famous and well known that it doesn't matter in regard to the individual artifacts. And he couldn't bring himself to do it. He had a couple of expert and experienced writers wanted to help him. Alan Gardner tried, and he just couldn't bring himself to write it. Although his unpublished journals show a facility with the English language and an authentic ability to express himself.
Now, you've written and edited several other books on the history of Egypt, on some Egyptologists, and on the topic of Egyptology. What was something new that you learned in the preparation of these volumes, or something that you had no idea about before that, you know, doing this research opened your eyes to?
I would have to answer that in almost transcendental terms. I think I learned that the enlightenment often comes from the effort, not finding the answer. That, you know, my approach was necessarily comprehensive, and an underlying question was, what makes ancient Egypt special? Why do we bother? What is it that provokes a response unlike any other ancient culture? Even children, my son, when he was in Egypt with me at age 6, I mean, as soon as he saw anything having to do with pharaonic Egypt, he was entranced. And there for years, when he would go with me out in the field, I'd have trouble keeping pencil and paper, because he would be making transcriptions of his own. And this is not a unique reaction. Ancient Egypt evokes a response, one that sometimes irritates Mesopotamian archaeologists and scholars, because they say, well, our culture is just as ancient. We have big monuments. We have a written language. We have two rivers. Egypt has just one. What is it that makes it so special? And I think I found little bits and pieces. But at the end of the day, the answer is still just over the horizon. Maybe perhaps that is the very thing that leads people on. When Auguste Mariette was talking about the decision to become an Egyptologist, he said, it's the duck. He was referring to the duck in the Pharaonic honorific, son, sa, which means both son and, it's a homophone, it says both son and duck, son of Ra. It was, for a long time, almost the only hieroglyph for which these early Egyptologists knew the meaning, thanks to the ancient for Apollo. And he said, well, that's it. The duck bites you, injects its venom, and there you are, an Egyptologist for life. And his explanation, as of now, I find as conclusive as any.
Yeah, that Egyptian duck is still biting people today. You know, you look in the history of ancient Egypt is an important part of, early elementary American school curriculum. And so it's sort of still reinforcing and getting people to be interested in Egyptology. I think one of the most interesting chapters for me to read was in volume 2, when Egyptology comes to America, and it touched on how anthropologists and some phrenologists did quote unquote studies of these mummies that showed that, that they used to then support their own racist white supremacist defense of slavery in America. And it just shows that in the 19th century, especially, Egyptology really became this global phenomenon, and that it had an impact far beyond just the study of, ancient Egypt and inscriptions and Egyptian history.
Yes, there was something extraordinary about the advent of Egyptology in the United States. And for that reason, although wonderful things, is in general constructive, its structure is a chronological narrative. In the case of the United States, I treated the early development before 1882, which is where volume 2 generally begins, there as a whole, with its merging into professional Egyptology in the United States. It is quite a story, and it illuminates so many of the aspects of American ideologies and prejudices through the very unique lens of ancient Egypt.
Now, another thing that this series touches on is that the history of Egyptology can also be seen as a history of sort of Western expropriation of Egyptian cultural heritage. Sometimes it's more or less restricted depending on the regime in charge, but Egyptology has almost always involved some sort of taking of artifacts, inscriptions, artworks, even full monuments out of Egypt. Recently, Egypt has renewed an initiative led by Zahi Hawass for the return of many of the important historical pieces that have been taken out of Egypt over the years. Do you see the attitude of Western countries and museums and collections changing at all? Do you foresee any sort of significant restitution movement, especially for objects that were maybe dubiously taken out of Egypt, like the limestone bust of Nefertiti in the Neues Museum in Berlin?
During recent years, there have been several gestures of called return, sometimes rather than restitution. Whether the bust of Nefertiti will return to Egypt anytime soon is questionable. I think history of Egyptology could be provide the answer to this if the facts were carefully examined, and then the processes were unraveled. A lot could be solved by asking, was the export legitimate? Now, it is a tragic fact that, say, from the time of Maspero's director generalship onward, vast amounts of Egyptian, the material remains of Egyptian antiquity were exported. I mean, they had been before, legally and illegally, but it became a recognized process. Maspero was happy that the objects were housed somewhere. So one could examine the basic legality of it. I think Zahi Hawass would have been happy to have had the Rosetta Stone returned. But looking at the process, it was actually legally exported. Perhaps some Ottoman Turkish authorities signed off on it. Perhaps the Egyptian people wished it had not been done, but at least it was done with some regularity. Now, there was some sleight of hand on that export of the Nefertiti bust that I think should be carefully considered, and the artifact kept where it properly belongs.
Yeah, I recall in an undergraduate class on ancient Egypt, hearing that story of the Nefertiti bust, that it was caked in mud to obscure, you know, the fine polychrome painting on it, or it was only shown in passing to the representatives from the Antiquities Service or something like that. Another thing this series does a great job of touching on is the tensions sometimes between Western and Egyptian Egyptologists. And for a long time, many Western Egyptologists held ideas about Egyptians, which meant that Egyptians were barred from studying their own history, or they weren't allowed to sort of be the ones in charge of large-scale excavations without a European archaeologist as the director. And this, of course, changed during the 20th century over time, but some inklings of that way of thinking might still be around in the field today. So what can we learn from the history of Egyptology and from, you know, frequently and consistently reconsulting the history of Egyptology that makes the current and future field maybe more equitable?
I think to a substantial degree, that ideal has been reached. A difficulty early on, of course, was the reluctance and refusal of Western Egyptologist who directed everything to train Egyptians. This has been documented time and time again. Such efforts that were made foundered for lack of resources, and lack of resources means lack of will somewhere. Long-term workers in Egypt, I suppose George Reisner would be a prime example of that. Even after Egyptian independence, his relations with his Egyptian workers, his raises, his photographers, and so forth, were close, intimate, familial. Nevertheless, he never trained one Egyptian, Egyptologist, and I don't think he had a good view of the Egyptians who were working at Giza, but that changed. Early on, it was recognized. One of the difficulties in the 1920s and 1930s that Egyptologists had with Pierre Lacaux, who was Director General of the service at that moment, they thought that he was obstinate, aloof, and unreasonable. Perhaps he was sometimes, but what they didn't understand was that the Egyptians were in charge and that he had to do things their own way, and that if people would, then things could be accomplished. And now, with the international connections, with the understanding that Egyptian antiquity is Egyptians, I think it has achieved a level of what you might call equitable. But you know, there are other dimensions too. One of the things that interested me and that I pursued as far as, you know, the limits of the format would enable me to do was women in Egyptology. Occasionally, I heard complaints about my first two volumes that there weren't enough women in them. Well, there weren't enough women in them for the reason that there weren't enough women. And then in the 20th century, apart from superstars like Amelia Edwards and some other notable but less remembered people, there's a progress from beginning in the pottery shed where so many would be found if they were to be found on site at all, because of course Walter Emery was famous for allowing no women on his operations at all, apart from his wife who was site manager. Now it's been quite a trajectory because of course in recent decades now women are occupying many, perhaps most, if a survey is to be made, of positions of power and influence within Egyptology.
All right. Well, one more thing is, one thing I found particularly interesting. You mentioned Lacaux and his decisions that maybe came from above him in the Egyptian government. To make the antiquities partage or the division of antiquities after excavation was completed more restrictive for archaeologists in around 1924, and how that decision led many prominent Egyptologists like Petrie to sort of pick up operations and move to Palestine, which recently came under British control after World War I, and had a more liberal division of antiquities policy. So I found that note particularly interesting. But I think we've... go ahead.
No, I was just... That's very true. Although some who went to Palestine later found things difficult there. And of course, Sudan as well, which was... That was a bonanza for Sudanese archaeology because things were less restrictive there, and the government was quite helpful whenever it could be, especially with rail transport and so forth. But it should be understood that once Lacan was able to settle everyone down, things continued quite well with respect to Egyptian sensitivities, legalities, and authority. The division of spoils regrettably continued. The sale room at the Egyptian Museum operated. And so the disruption or the interference, as some Egyptologists considered it, was actually never so great as they complained it was.
Well, I think we've taken up enough of your time today, so I just have one more question. What's next? Is there anything that you're currently working on that you can share with us? Give us a little teaser.
Just now, I'm midway through a project about Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton, the Victorian writer, explorer, and adventurer, made the Hajj to Mecca, searched for the sources of the Nile, and many, many other things, and concluded with his famous translation of the Arabian Nights. This, like Egyptology, has taken me a lot of places. My approach is always more one of collective biography rather than focusing on a single person. And it's also taken me to Egypt, because there is no escape from Egyptology, because even Burton was involved with it. He knew people like Maret, Lenant de Belfond, and Archibald Sacy, and many others, and encouraged the development of Egyptology. Long term, perhaps a return to the history of Egyptology with a video to demonstrate some of its remarkable pictorial dimension.
All right, so another biography to look forward to sometime in the near future. As I mentioned, all three volumes of Wonderful Things, A History of Egyptology, are out now from American University in Cairo Press. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Sam.
Pleasure on my end, too. All right, so tune in for future episodes. Thank you.